This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Morton Marcus is an Indiana economist. He's a writer and a speaker, and he puts out a column which is called Eye on the Pie. It's out in local media and around the Hoosier State as well. And he comes on Regionally Speaking to talk about his various topics from time to time. And he's with us today to bring us up to date on some of the latest Eye on the Pie columns. And Morton, thank you for joining us as always.
Well, I'm delighted to do this. I understand you have a bit of snow up north.
Yeah, we have a few inches up here. We were just remarking here before the program began that at least it's rather fluffy. So it's there, but at least you can get around. But it was a real difficult time for travelers to get around this morning when it was still snowing. So mm-hmm. We lucked out.
Well, rather fluffy fits many of the people that you interview. Yes,
that's probably true too. Yeah, I didn't want to think about that. Well, speaking of interviews, let's talk about some of the folks that you get to talk to about various topics for the Eye on the Pie column. And in fact, the last two latest ones deal with Hoosier schools, and in particular, the one that's out today talks about a very serious problem that schools had faced, of course, for years, the issue of cigarette smoking, when you were talking about regular cigarettes, but now we're talking about vaping. And one of your latest columns goes into that in more detail.
Yes, we have cut back on a lot of cigarette smoking in our society. Smokers, you know, stand outside a building and sound pathetic if you walk by and talk to them about how they're being discriminated against. The new danger that we have is vaping, these electronic cigarettes that have more nicotine per puff than any cigarette. And on top of that, they last longer. So, you know, the cigarette has a natural ending to that particular event, smoking that cigarette. But with some of these vaping devices, you can smoke much longer than you could possibly smoke a cigarette. So not only are they delivering more, but at the same time, more nicotine, but at the same time, they are keeping you occupied with nicotine addiction for longer. And what this means for the schools is that they are being hit by more disruption in class, because some students are actually bringing these things into class because they see a sign that says no smoking, and they say, oh, that applies to cigarettes. And they can say that they're trying to break the cigarette habit, because the makers of these e-cigarettes basically are lying. You know, they say, oh, this is for kicking the habit. And what they're really doing is marketing to very young people, as young as junior high school students.
I know one of your things that you mentioned in the column talks about the fact that there is a multi-state lawsuit that's out there, but representing a number, at least a couple hundred school districts around the country, but very few of them from Indiana are participating. What seems to be at least your concern about them not jumping in there?
I can't figure that out, and some people I've talked to can't figure it out. Some school districts don't want to admit that they have a problem. That's one possible thing. Another thing is they're afraid they'll have to put some upfront money into this. Well, they don't have to, because this is one of those contingency situations where the attorneys take, I don't know, 30% maybe of whatever settlement there is. So they've got the idea that, no, we're going to have to put up money. And they don't have to. All they have to do is fill out a questionnaire saying that they telling their experiences with vaping in their school and what they've done about it. Because what this lawsuit is trying to recover is some of the expenses that our schools have to make to treat these young people. They have health concerns. They have lots of difficulties. We're turning our teachers and our counselors into some kind of, I don't know, almost hospital recovery places. That's mm-hmm. not their job. Their job is to teach and to counsel our students on what kinds of courses to take and how to think about various issues. They're not there as addiction monitors. So we've got a serious problem, and these schools could get reimbursed if this lawsuit can be won. And that's exactly what happened with medical facilities, hospitals and others, and the states, which put out money to treat cigarette addiction. And that lawsuit was very successful. The state of Indiana has received a vast amount of money, $2.9 billion with the B, for smoking cessation programs. And even last year, 2021, they brought in $146 million being paid by the courts to our state. Because this was such a serious matter, trying to get people off of cigarettes. Mm-hmm. We've been successful. Yes, I know there are still people around who smoke, but they're fewer and fewer in number, and that's because in part they kill themselves off. It's a terrible way to look at it, and I mm-hmm. know that some of your listeners will be disturbed because they've had relatives who have died from cigarette smoking. But the issue is that's what we want to cut back on. We don't want people to be dying from their addictions. It ruins a family, and we have families have enough trouble these days. So going after these producers of these vaping devices, I think is a very worthwhile situation, mm-hmm. and no school should have hesitations about doing this. And yet, again, we've only got a few of Indiana schools, 15 schools, and most of those are large schools. Maybe they think that they have to have staff to answer their questionnaire. I don't think so. There's a lot of questions that are yes or no. And if you haven't had these problems, or you don't have the particular kinds of documents that they're looking for, doesn't mean that you can't be eligible part of this class suit.
Well, hopefully more school districts will wisen up and they'll join on the lawsuit. I guess we'll just have to wait to see. We're talking with Morton Marcus. He's an Indiana economist and writer and speaker about his recent Eye on the Pie columns. And a couple of them touch on the economic matters involving COVID-19. One talks about, I guess, how Indiana performed compared to other states from the economic decline and rebound. And another one as well, too, talks more about, the GDP. Will you fill us in on those, please?
Well, Indiana did fairly well in coming out of this recession. You know, we, like other states, had a major decline, but we did well coming out of the recession. And that looks very nice. And when the governor gets up and gives his State of the State address, you know, he can be proud because Indiana managed to at least match the national figures. But that's not the long-term view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the governor really shouldn't be talking about just the short term. He really needs to talk about the longer term, which to me is at least a 10-year period of time. It goes well beyond just the governor's terms in office. I recently looked at a 12-year span starting in 2007, and that's the last year we had before that terrible financial breakdown that we had in 2008 and that carried on into 2009. And then we were coming out of that, not as well as the rest of the nation on the long haul, because Indiana is not a fast-growing state by any means. We're way down in the middle ranks of state growth. But nonetheless, we came in, 23rd among all the states in the recovery period. the recovery and recession period put together, 2007 to 2019. And I think we ought to remember that we are a slower growing state. And do we want to accelerate that? And I ask that as a very legitimate question, because maybe we feel that we've got already too many people working. You know, that's heresy to suggest that, because they're saying we've got to get more jobs. I'm not sure we need to get more jobs. We need to get better paying jobs. But more jobs would mean more people to work in them, and more people is not necessarily the best thing for many of our communities. And all you have to do is have trouble driving to work in the morning, and you'll understand the congestion that we have in our major metropolitan areas. There are all sorts of problems that come with being bigger. Now, our smallest communities don't have those problems. Their problem is not growth. Their problem is decline. And one of the things I think we need to do about this as a long-term growth matter is to help smaller communities grow and not just have sprawl the way we've got it. You know, I see this new Franciscan hospital being built down near I-65 and Crown Point, exit 247, if my memory is correct. I know so many people really latch on to exit numbers the way I do, but exit 247. Why are we building down there rather than building closer to the population centers of Lake County? And you can say, well, the land is cheaper. Yes, that's true. And you can say, well, they're thinking about the future. Yes, that's true. But we've got to think about the future of the cities that we abandoned in order to move to Crown Point or to move into St. John or to abandon it, Hammond and East Chicago and Gary and Griffith and most of the more northern cities, and we move south. And even within Lake County, or we're moving into Jasper County, into the DeMott area. This is urban sprawl, which doesn't really help anybody. It helps the people who like to drive the John Deere or somebody else's lawnmower over their vast lawn. And to me, grass is an objectionable plant. Mm-hmm. We ought to get rid of grass. I've even suggested that we tax grass. That the more grass you have around the house, that should be taxed at a higher rate because it's not environmentally friendly. And because it gets people out there doing things that they could do something better. Every time I see somebody on a lawnmower, man or woman driving one of these lawnmowers, very often on a rather small piece of land, I think to myself, couldn't they be doing something? Couldn't they go into a hospital and visit with someone? Well, COVID blocks that off. But there are many other good things that people could do. You're not getting any real exercise when you're out there with a big lawnmower. You're not really doing very much for your society when you're out there. I don't even think you're doing much for your family, unless your family likes getting rid of you for several hours.
Well, and sometimes it takes that long to mow the grass, too, in some places, I know.
Absolutely.
So, well, there are so many things we need to catch up on over time, and we're going to have to do it another time, I guess. And also, too, we should mention that Morton has a podcast that's out there called Who Gets What? And look it up at wherever you normally get your podcasts and check that one out, too. Morton Marcus is a Hoosier economist. He's a writer and a speaker, and he's now a podcast host. And thank you for spending time with us to talk about your Eye on the Pie columns here recently. Hope you have you back on again real soon. Thanks very much.
Real good. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. Bye. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, life may be unpredictable, so it seems anyway these days, but there is one fact that remains. Taxes exist, and they aren't going to go away. But more Americans should be aware of the ever-changing tax system because it does have an impact on you. And there are some potential changes that could come this year that Americans should really know about because it will affect future tax bills. To find out more on how you can deal with it in the right kind of tax planning strategy for this year, we ask local financial advisor Greg Hammer to be with us. Greg, thanks for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, there's some changes coming up in the laws we should know about, and I guess we should start on the right kind of strategy for, among other things, being sure that your retirement contributions is at the maximum level. Tell us first about what we should be doing if we have a 401k.
Yeah, and like every year, they did increase the contribution amounts this year, Chris, and they upped it $1,000 more. So what was previously $19,500 is now $20,500 for your contribution level.
Mm-hmm.
And the catch-up contribution is up to $6,500. So anybody 50 or older can contribute as much as $27,000. And, you know, like always, we always recommend make sure at the very least you're taking advantage of those matching dollars. So if you're on the auto contributions and, you know, future raises are always a great time to say, hey, let's bump it up. There should be room to do stuff.
And you should not forget that if your company offers a match, take advantage of every single penny of it.
Absolutely. I tell people to always take the free money because that's a, you know, going to be money that's working for you, and adding it to initially in that dollar cost averaging arena creates generally a lot of value long term.
Now, if you happen to have a traditional or a Roth IRA, what things you should know about to make sure that you meet everything that you plan for being able to save back and be able to meet the tax strategies you're going to have to do?
Yeah, so what's unusual today is this year they did not increase the amount you can contribute to the IRA. So it's still at $6,000, and that is a combined contribution. So you cannot do six in the traditional and then six in the Roth. It's a six aggregate. You can split it any way, 100% one direction or 50-50. And then the catch-up provision for 50 and over is $1,000. So that brings the contribution up to $7,000, which, again, is the same as last year. However, if you did not max out your IRA contributions last year and you're looking to do so in that regards, you still have until April's tax filing deadline to make a contribution for 21. So that's a way to hopefully catch up a little bit more than just the $6,000 or $7,000 you're eligible. If you did not take full advantage last year, you can, you know, steal some of that amount as well. And then, and essentially, if you didn't contribute anything last year, can do upwards of $12,000 to $14,000.
Mm-hmm. I know some people have changed jobs. Maybe they had a 401k with their former employer. Can you still keep that alive? Do you have to change everything over when you change jobs?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing we always talk about this, Chris, is a lot of people, when they change jobs, especially if it's not a large amount, they just have a tendency to cash in. And just keep in mind, as you cash in, there's a 10% penalty. You know, where a lot of times you can leave it with the existing 401k, move it over potentially to whatever your new company is if they offer the similar type of program, or move it to a traditional IRA and then even consider things like Roth conversions, and in all cases would avoid that 10% penalty.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about some strategies that you probably should keep in mind for planning taxes as you go into 2022, because there are some changes that will be coming about. And one of the things I know that people are keeping an eye on these days is the advanced child tax credit payment. Will you fill us in on what the changes are going to be and what one should do?
Yeah, so there's a couple things with it. You know, one, it was upped to $3,000 for the year 2021, so it's going to revert back to $2,000 per child under age 17. Also, just to keep in mind, a lot of folks were advanced that credit. They were receiving a monthly stipend for the, I think it was about the last 6 months of the year. So in essence, they've used up that credit. So that will be reflected on the tax return, and they might just be a little bit confusing as to, you know, why am I not getting the type of refund I have in the past, is because essentially they've paid that credit out in advance, you know, to keep people through this pandemic. And the parents filing jointly earning less than $150,000 are eligible for the total amount, and then it begins to phase out as you exceed that income, and for the single parents it's $75,000.
Mm-hmm.
But again, just a reminder, they won't be doing that in a monthly payment in 2022 as of the current information, and it will revert back to the 2000.
One of the other things that we should probably keep an eye on, too, if you're planning for a good tax strategy for this coming year, is looking at the net investment income tax. Will you explain what that is to people that may not be aware of it? They may even know about it, and it probably hits them as a surprise if they've never had to deal with it before.
Yeah, and you hit it right in the head there, Chris, because there's nothing intuitive I tell people about the federal tax code. So there's a lot of things that we call marginal taxes, which basically as you reach certain levels of income or as you take certain distributions or you have certain events like net investment income, capital gains, dividends, things of that nature, they're not straightforward. So there's things that will determine whether or not you're paying taxes on those. And in the net investment income, if your income exceeds as a joint family above $250,000, well, then those gains, those investment gains, are subject to an additional tax. So that's something to keep in mind if you're close to that benchmark, that you may want to look at ways to reduce that income, either by contributing more to a 401k or, more importantly, looking at opportunities to be more tax favorable in your approach towards investing. In other words, minimize those taxable events. And it's also important to kind of keep your eye on the Build Back Better Act. Currently, it would change how the net investment income tax is going to work, where you're going to see significantly higher dollar amounts. So instead of the $200 for a single filer and $250 for a joint, they're talking upwards of $400,000 for single and up to $500,000 for a joint before you start experiencing that net investment income tax.
Well, and finally, let's talk about a surtax on wealthy Americans. How is the change that's liable to come about through the tax code going into effect this year have an impact on that?
Well, and this is one of those things that, I wish I was a problem with, right, Chris? Because if you had more than, $10 million of income, then you're going to be subject to these additional fees. And it's just one of the laws that they changed within the wealthy Americans. Typically will not pertain to most individuals, but it is a plan change that's pretty significant when you talk about the percentage on that dollar amount. One other thing I did want to mention, Chris, is the big thing that I talk about today with taxes is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is scheduled to sunset in 2025, meaning, as of 2026, we'll revert back to the old tax codes. And so if you haven't had a discussion or look seriously at whether or not Roth conversions would make sense for you, I would encourage everyone to take a closer look because the taxes are going to change and revert back to the old code. And when that happens, things are going to become more expensive to take distributions. So Roth conversion planning could create a lot of tax mitigation and a lot of tax saving opportunities for individuals that have pre-tax accounts like 401ks, traditional IRAs, 457 plans, things of that nature. Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that you're busy with your clients talking about the current tax returns that have to be filed before the deadline, but when you have them in the office, do you have and your colleagues have a chance to talk with them about some of these strategies they need to bring up and some adjustments they need to make so that when they go through 2022, when it's time to do those future tax bills, they're not going to be caught unaware?
I think you hit it right on the head there, Chris. I mean, that is a significant part of what we feel is proactive in the tax process because preparation, for the most part, is looking backwards. If you come get your taxes done this year, there's nothing we're going to change about how the return's going to look because the events have already occurred. Moving forward, when you have opportunities like Roth conversions, these expansions of the net investment income, preferential treatment and capital gains, different limits for contributions. All these things create opportunity for planning so we can change what the future tax returns look like and create a lot of potential tax savings and mitigate against where likely taxes are going to trend as we continue to see debt increase.
That's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. And as always, Greg, thank you for taking time out of a very busy tax return season to talk with us about some of these things we need to plan for the rest of this year and the next future tax years. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Audubon Great Lakes, which is an organization that is well known in the country, and especially here in the Midwest, oversees climate and energy policy work, along with other things. And the gentleman we're talking to next is a policy director with Audubon Great Lakes. Adam Forer likes to focus on Indiana and his work with Audubon Great Lakes. And he's going to tell us now about a news poll that is out, just out here this, in recent weeks, that shows that there are a lot of Hoosiers, and it doesn't matter, I guess, which political party or bent that you happen to be of, are more interested in renewable energy than you realize. And Adam, thank you for spending time on Regionally Speaking to talk about it today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Chris.
Well, first of you, we'll talk a bit about the methodology, because when polls come out, we just know that numbers get put together and crunched and the results get publicized. But how did this particular poll come about, that Audubon Great Lakes wanted to find out if Hoosiers are really interested in renewable energy?
Yeah, so we surveyed 600 voters in Indiana late in December. We used a combination of landlines and text to web. And our poll ended up with about a margin there of plus or minus 4%. So a really accurate poll for us.
Mm-hmm. What organization, I was going to ask what organization worked together with you folks to put everything together, did the calls and talk to people to get their views?
Yeah, we worked with Public Opinion Strategies, which is a nationally recognized firm, and they have extensive experience in Indiana polling for Republican candidates, successful candidates for statewide elections. So we were really glad to partner with them because they have a ton of experience in the state and really, again, helped us put together a really fantastic poll.
Did you ask the folks putting the poll together and doing the calls anything in particular that you wanted to learn from Hoosiers about their interest in, first off, in renewable energy in general, and whether you think that the Hoosier State ought to be more involved in it?
Yeah, we in our polling, we wanted to find out a couple of different things. Audubon has identified climate change as the biggest threat to birds. So we wanted to find out how Hoosiers felt about the expansion of renewable energy and some of the policies that go along with that. And we found that in Indiana, 74% of voters favored the expansion of renewable energy in the state. And in addition to that, we found that 75% supported a policy called net metering, which in really simple terms, the policy that just compensates customers who have something, let's say, like rooftop solar panels for the excess energy that they put back onto their grid. So across the board, Hoosiers, regardless of their political party, of their political ideology, support these policies that are good for both people and birds.
Now, since this is a policy that puts, I guess, the best advantages together of solar panels as well as energy that can be generated through the wind to use, and I guess for some people save some money if they're able to sell that back to the utility, did you find that there was anything in particular that a certain percentage of the population that maybe was either of Republican support or independent or Democratic Party support showed their interest for the idea of a net metering policy?
Yeah, regardless of if you are a Republican, independent, or a Democrat, our polling found that net metering is widely popular in Indiana. We found that 74% of Republicans favored net metering, independents 71%, and Democrats 84%. So those are really strong numbers for a policy that really helps to lead to the expansion of renewable energy generation in the state.
Now, I know this is an important time to talk about the topic of net metering policy because there is a measure that is moving through the 2022 General Assembly that might make a big difference if it gets passed and enacted into law. Will you tell us a little more about this measure that State Senator Liz Brown has proposed and what kind of impact it might have for people that want to take advantage of net metering?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now, net metering policy as it stands is set to expire in July. And that's going to be replaced by a different policy. And really, this legislation that we're talking about, Senator Brown, would just clarify how Hoosiers with solar panels on their roofs who are participating in net metering or who would participate in net metering, how that benefit is calculated. Across the history of looking at these policies, monthly netting, so calculating the energy generated and the credits on a monthly basis, has always been the intention of the program. And Senate Bill 248 would clarify that Hoosiers participating in this program, that calculation would be done on a monthly basis.
what, as far as you know, has happened with the measure so far? Is it moving along, as I'm sure that Senator Brown would like to have done in the Senate, and maybe make its way into the Indiana House for review?
You know, we haven't seen much movement on it this session. This is a quick session. It's a fast session. There are a lot of things going on. But we're hopeful that there's a possibility that we could see some movement on it, especially with the issue coming up. It seems like the time is expiring, for lack of a better term, in order to see some additional action on this. But it's a really important policy for clarifying how benefits are calculated in the state of Indiana when it comes to energy that's put back onto the grid. So if it's not addressed this session, we're hopeful that the next session it can come back up as well, because, again, this policy is a policy that's popular. It's a policy that would really help the expansion of renewable energy generation in the state, and really add to some clarity around the policy that will be in effect in July.
We're talking with Adam Forer, who is the Policy Director for Climate for Audubon Great Lakes, about a new survey that is out that has been conducted across Indiana, looking into renewable energy in the Hoosier State. And let's go back to the survey here and the results that you found, Adam. You mentioned earlier in our conversation about the fact that about 74%, including about 63% of Republicans, favor the expansion of renewable energy sources. How did the breakout show, I guess, in particular, about not only expansion, but extending net metering? Since you mentioned we have this measure that is moving, well, not moving right now, but could be moving through the General Assembly to make some changes.
Absolutely. So we did ask about the expansion of net metering. We found that 65% of Hoosiers prefer extending and expanding net metering, and only 10% wanted to see the policy end. And again, across Republicans, Independents, and Democrats, the expansion and extension of net metering is popular. We saw that 57% of Republicans wanted to see the extension and expansion of net metering, 62% with Independents, and 82% with Democrats. Mm-hmm. So not only is the policy itself popular, but extending net metering, expanding the policy, is something that's really popular among Hoosier voters.
I guess you mentioned that back there are a number of Republicans, a surprising number of Republicans, at least from your survey, found they are supportive of renewable energy. These strong numbers, are they any surprise to you folks with Audubon Great Lakes?
No, certainly not. I think there's been some pretty good polling done in the state, specifically around conservative views on renewable energy. The Indiana Conservative Alliance for Energy is a group that we work with often, and they did some polling last year as well. Around similar topics. This is an issue when it comes to net metering, when it comes to renewable energy expansion. Across the political spectrum, voters are interested in seeing more renewable energy and supporting net metering. So this is the results of our polling weren't surprising, but hopefully they contribute to the body of knowledge that's out there about how popular these policies are and how much, no matter who you are or what side of the political aisle you're on, that these are widely supported.
Does it seem that it kind of goes along with the idea that the conservatives as well as moderates and even liberals want to be sure that they can have the opportunity to make their own decision about the choice of energy, where they get it, how much they pay for it?
I think it's certainly consistent. I mean, we in Indiana, our electricity right now, only 10% of our electricity comes from renewable sources. Mm-hmm. So we certainly have a ways to go in order to expand how much renewable energy is generated in the state. And I think that's reflected in our polling. I think that's reflected in other polling and really speaks to the popularity of these kinds of generation sources.
Now, do you and your colleagues at Audubon Great Lakes support what has been done so far, or at least the current proposals for expanding renewable energy, like for example, the ones that NIPSCO has on their plans to be able to add more solar energy farms and wind generation farms out there?
We certainly need to see expanded renewable energy in the state. As I mentioned before, climate change is the biggest threat to birds. Two-thirds of bird species are at risk due to climate change. And so we really need to continue to expand our renewable energy offerings in order to protect birds in the places that they need.
Now, do you and your colleagues, Adam, go down to Indianapolis and lobby with lawmakers on a regular basis? Certainly, you're keeping a very close eye on the Senate Bill 248 that State Senator Brown has put out here about renewable energy and in turn the costs that and the excess energy that might generate and how those costs are properly used. Are there any other ideas that you'd like to propose or it's on the drawing board that Audubon Great Lakes wants to take down to Indianapolis?
I think some of the policies that we're looking at, in addition to 248, are policies that would extend and expand net metering. As I mentioned, that's supposed to expire in July. But we are supportive of extending and expanding net metering, clarifying the netting issue or the netting process that will take over after net metering expires in July, so that those who have rooftop solar who are sending electricity back to the grid are fairly compensated. And also, Audubon's supportive of responsibly sited renewable energy. So we're looking at policies that help, again, to contribute to the expansion of renewable energy generation in the state. Because if we don't continue to expand the amount of electricity in the state that is generated by renewable energy, birds are going to be a significant threat. And so the expansion of renewable energy is one of those solutions.
Adam Forer is a policy director at Audubon Great Lakes, and he oversees climate and energy policy work, and he focuses in particular on Indiana. Adam, thank you for joining us, talking about what the efforts are that Audubon Great Lakes are doing. As a result of the survey that was done and all the information you're gathering from it, it looks like it's off to more expansion of renewable energy in Indiana very soon. And thank you for spending time to talk about it today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Chris.
You're welcome. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. And coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll talk with Tammy Silverman from the Indiana Youth Institute about the Indiana efforts to support mentors since this is National Mentoring Month. We hope you can join us for that conversation.